The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky, and on this week's program, we're reporting on the smartphone market, a handset ecosystem that's set to reach critical mass in the next 12 months in the UK. Once more than half of the UK population has access to all the features, what will this mean for how we consume online content and for trends in the UK software development market? In other news, David Cameron launched the UK's latest open data initiative, releasing a new tranche of public data for use by developers. We hear what new insights can be gained and whether or not this data has been specifically chosen to advance the Tory agenda. And here on Tech Weekly, we spend a lot of time talking about privacy issues, but most of it tends to be related to the corporations behind social networks, search engines, and other publishing systems. So, what about punters who hijack computers for the sake of art? A New York-based artist has been detained by the U.S. Secret Service for, quote, fraud and related activities, for uploading software on public computers at Apple stores around the city, and then capturing images of shoppers looking at the screens. Joining me to debate these stories and more are digital media correspondent Jemima Kish and technology editor Charles Arthur. Welcome to you both.
Hello.
Hi.
So Jemima, is this what Calm McDonald did? Is this a breach of privacy or a clever piece of observational digital art?
Probably a bit of both, but there's nothing wrong with being a controversial artist, I think.
Certainly not. Charles, I mean, have you ever seen anything like this before?
It sounds a bit like a passage out of Neal Stephenson's book Cryptonomicon, where he is, where the sort of the chief hacker has got a whole lot of people along who are bidding for something that the company has, and he installs a little program in his computer which will take a snapshot of the people as they look at the computer. But he is a very clever hacker, so he hides the program that does this under a different name so that if they look to see whether there's a program looking to take a picture of them, it won't show up.
Ah, well, perhaps this is an inspiration for McDonald's.
We're doing this right now with all the Tech Weekly podcast listeners. We're taking pictures of you right now.
That's it, on your smartphones.
Getting into our book.
You have no idea what we're doing with that data. If all this amazing content wasn't enough, we have an elevator pitch from Mark McLaughlin from Ticket ABC, who will tell us why his white label ticketing system will succeed. Join us for the next 30 minutes of news and analysis on Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Last Thursday, the UK's Prime Minister David Cameron visited the technology hub of London, Shoreditch, in the east of the city, to reach out to local developers and to announce the next phase of the Open Data Initiative promised during their election campaign. Charles, you've been following this Open Data Initiative. What is the content that was released this week?
Well, it's more a set of commitments to release data.
I've heard this before, Charles. Are we ever actually going to get anything?
No. The data is starting to come out. But I mean, this is about what sort of things are going to come out next. I mean, given that we've had the Treasury releasing its coins database, which is a big mess, but there is more and more data coming out through data.gov.uk. But this was about commitments to provide sets of new data that you wouldn't previously be able to get. So there was stuff like the NHS, data on comparative clinical outcomes of GP practices, prescribing data, complaints data, clinical audit data, anonymized data from national parks, criminal justice data about enhancing crime maps and details of where crimes are solved.
Charles, this all feels... I know, there's a whole
financial
bunch of data there. There's loads and loads of data that they've made commitments to release, but most of it feels like it's performance data. So, you know, it can be used for the Tories to say, look how awesome we are. Look, big society, we've been doing amazing things. Are they actually releasing anything that could potentially put them in troubled water?
That's hard to know. I mean, the thing about performance data is that's what people like to measure. You have a metric because you want to measure something. So yes, it's all about the performance data. It'll be interesting to see whether issues like waiting times appear in there, whether post-hospital mortality, those sorts of subtle things that doctors like to measure. You know, people like Ben Goldacre will measure to see whether certain sorts of treatment work better or worse. It'll be interesting to see if those come out there. But it's the whole idea of it is that it's aggregate, that once you start releasing this data, then you start to say, well, we're releasing this stuff, and it's a bit of a hassle. Why do we have to, why not just release the whole lot?
I think the danger here is that data can be a very blunt instrument. I mean, for this to be a really powerful, positive, empowering, as the Prime Minister said, thing for consumers, two things need to happen. One is that the data that they gather is really, really good quality, because it doesn't matter what you do with that data. You know, if it's a bit sort of icky to start with,
rubbish, not really, rubbish out, that's what they say.
Yeah, well, it's not really going to be of any value. It doesn't matter how beautiful it is on the other end. And that's the second part of this, is it comes down to the imagination and skill of the developers that use it to put a really beautiful interface on it.
Well, in addition, there's an interesting trend in academic research. You can actually get more funding if you use existing data sets, simply because that means that you're not producing more data, more knowledge, whatever. And because there's, you know, a historical tranche of performance data, it allows you to reassess and reanalyze. I'm actually wondering if there is more support for academic institutions for this kind of data, or if this really truly is trying to get outside the ivory tower and it's really trying to engage developers in this for commercial purposes. Charles, what do you think?
It's very much about getting developers in there. There are people like Tom Steinberg inside the Cabinet Office, who, you know, Tom Steinberg is the guy who's set up My Society, the charity, and so you have things like What Do They Know, and you know, the whole sort of system of being able to look at Hansard without having to trundle through Hansard, and they're pushing an open data agenda very strongly. So I think that the data is going to be about as good as you can get it without actually being right there on the ground. You know, there's no reason to make it not good quality, because if you have not good quality, then people won't use it, and then the whole thing fails.
If you look at Schooloscope as well, which the team at Berg came up with, that was a really interesting interface on data about quality of schools. But it demonstrates the particular kind of expertise you need in putting an interface on this data, so that it puts it in the right context, so that people really understand what they're looking at, because data very often isn't black and white. The issues that people are looking around health and education and all of these really important areas require much more than just a sort of yes or no in a box.
And additionally, when it comes to commercial organizations or design organizations or even individuals, thinking about David McCandless's Data is Beautiful initiative, much of that analysis and much of the way that's presented to the public, because ultimately if these are for commercial organizations to make this available to the public, that tends to have more of an agenda. It tends to have some kind of, you know, driving dogma behind it. And I'm wondering to what extent and whether there is any stipulation in the use of this data that those agendas are made transparent. Because data, while it isn't necessarily black and white, it does have a lot of...
It has the appearance of neutrality.
Yes, it does have the appearance.
Being subjective.
But
yeah,
it certainly isn't. I don't know the Berg software that you're talking about. But, you know, what if they were specifically, you know, weighting data in one way or another, and people, you know, responded to that?
Well, this is where using third-party developers is a clever move by the government, because that, again, gives it the appearance of neutrality. But I would question whether this data can ever be completely objective.
Charles, how does what they've released this time, or what they've announced that they're committing to release this time, fit in with their overall agenda? Back in the day when we were speaking with each of the parties about what it was that they had intended to do before the election, how does this fit in, and where else do we need to go? What else do we need?
This fits pretty well, actually, with the whole agenda, and it shows that Francis Maude, who's the actual minister who's driving the open data initiative from within the Cabinet Office, is actually starting to get the message out. So yes, it is starting to, you know, all the pieces are starting to come together. It's all starting to fit together. Local government, there's still some progress to be made there, and that's a very hard nut to crack, because it's not monolithic in the same way that central government is. I would say that there's still the train operating companies, the data from them, from their trains, although there's a commitment here with transport to have things like timetables, make that available for free reuse or commercial reuse. What a lot of developers do want is much more access to more detailed data about running of trains, and there's a lot of pushback from the train operating companies on that. And I'd say that actually we still want things like environmental data, which is held in sort of third-party arms-length agencies, but which are in effect arms of the government, but because of the commercial setup means that they aren't officially a government department.
They're not necessarily obliged through a decree.
I think Environment Agency, is still the touchstone for this, of whether we're really in the sort of the idea we have for the Free Our Data project, which is about getting everything.
And where does the UK stand globally on its open data initiatives? Because you've mentioned data.gov, which is the US-based system. Where is the UK at the moment?
Actually, the UK stands out as having some of the best availability of open data for developers. The US has been sort of reining back a bit on it because it's got so many budget problems that legislators there are looking to cut back on anything they can, and they've been doing things like cutting back on data.gov. And the problem with data.gov was that it was sort of static. It wasn't a portal, whereas the strength of data.gov.uk is it is a portal. It just links through to where the data is.
Jemima, very briefly.
It will also be interesting to look at David Cameron's stated aim to open our agencies, to make them open to more commercial businesses, to make them what effect is that going to have on the data? Is it going to make it more open? Because it would seem not to.
More information on the data that was released and how you can access it, and some of the services that have already started sifting through it, on guardian.co.uk/technology. Also this week, new data in about the smartphone market indicates that Google's Android operating system has become the leader in 6 out of 8 key territories. Charles, you've seen the data. It's all about data this week. You've seen the data. What's the latest? How did this happen?
How did it happen? Because people bought phones. They all bought lots and lots of smartphones. Smartphones are just starting to take over the whole of the mobile phone business. So, for example, if you look at the UK, June. This is data which has come from Kantar Comtech, by the way, who gather it by interviewing people in all the relevant countries.
They interview. It's
statistically relevant.
So it's a market research. It's not as if it's
market
scraped.
Research. Phone companies, or it's not out of shops and stuff. So there's a possibility that understates the number of people and enterprises, but it is representative of the population. So if you look at the UK in June of 2010, number of people using non-smartphones was about 78% of the population. People with smartphones was about 22% of the population. And of that, Symbian had the largest share at about 9%. Apple was next with 5.6%.
And Symbian was present on the Nokia system, yeah.
Fast forward to June of 2011 in the UK, non-smartphones, feature phones, is about 63%. Smartphones have gone up to 37%. And in that, actually, the iPhone is still the largest proportion. It's got 10% or so. Android's at about 9%. In the US, it's gone from 78% last year of feature phones, 22%, to now it's about 70% non-smartphones, 30%. So, you can see the direction of travel here.
Are people actually seeking these out? Are they saying, I want a smartphone? Or is this just an artifact of people's contracts with their previous phones have ended and they're upgrading? Or have they seen people using Android phones or Apple iPhones and say, my God, I must have that? Or is it just evolution?
It's a combination of contracts expiring. So, 2-year contracts expire. People come up to look at things. They go to the shop and what are they offered? Hey, we've got this iPhone. Hey, we've got this Android phone. Hey, we've got this BlackBerry. That's the sort of way that these things are going. I think that people on prepay are going to be a bit slower to do that. I think that there's going to be a fair amount of slower change there because people on prepay tend to be paying the full cost of the phone up front. So they're going to be more reluctant to make the change. Or else they'll flip to contract, which is sort of what a lot of the operators, the carriers are starting to drive people towards. Some of the pricing changes on things like cost of calls and cost of texts that's been made in the last few months are driving the prepay customers who are doing a fair amount of it towards contract. So when they move to contract, it's quite likely that they'll be shifting to smartphones as well.
It's interesting that you say that because there's quite a lot of data as well that you received about what it is that people are using these systems for. So in the UK, how are UK people? People from the UK.
How are people using our phones? The UK? Okay, so taking pictures is actually a large a large part of what people with feature phones do, and it's a really large part of what people with smartphones do. But of course, you can imagine that people with smartphones are then loading it up. Internet navigation is very popular. About 3/4 of people with smartphones do that, compared to only about 40% if they're using feature phones, because obviously it's just a lot harder. You know, navigation becomes a big thing. Downloading and searching the web, that's a big part. And using social networking, you know, about half. Two-thirds of owners of smartphones do that, compared to around 1/5 of the feature phone owners. You know, it's all about the getting engaged thing. Looking at the numbers for the US, you know, taking pictures, internet navigation, sending and receiving emails, downloading, social networks, you know, all these things are really big on smartphones in a way that they're simply not at all in feature phones. So you can see that, you know, as people get into using more social networks, as they're getting, you know, more engaged in all these things, they're going to look for a smartphone.
Jemima, this is really interesting, because certainly in Japan and Korea, a few years ago, we saw the drive of smartphones, incredible drive, because of the connections, because of the things like social networks and also browsing. How do you think that this is, because so many people are using it to browse, how do you think this might change how we consume information?
Well, there's a big incentive in how good the apps are, actually. And I think if you've got really good apps, then you're much more likely to use a service. And from the statistics here, it does look like Apple have nailed a few key services better than Android have, because they have a higher proportion of users doing most things, actually, from emails to browsing to taking pictures and using GPS. If we look to the future, though, I think as our phones become more and more central to our lives, and we already use our phones a lot when we're at home and we have the choice of using a desktop because it's there. And often apps are just a much more direct way of getting the information we need, and so it's quicker. But looking at areas like health and education, I think our phones are going to become even more central to our lives. And there's this idea of the Internet of Things. So our phone is a sensor. At the moment, it's a sensor for location and for a range of other things. But you'll be able to get peripheral devices. So if you're diabetic, for example, there'll be an app to monitor your blood sugar. And that will be something you can manage through your phone, or your weight, or kind of education, all sorts of education tools that plug in. So there'll be an explosion of apps in very particular, much more kind of professional areas.
Really interesting thing, actually, you mentioned Japan there. Most of the phones used in Japan don't class as smartphones, although they're used in a way that we might think of them that way. Actually, Japan is pretty much a wasteland. Japan is feature phones almost everywhere. The thing is that the networks are much more capable, and the phones have sort of built-in apps which sort of do this. But Japan is not a land where people do a lot of downloading. Yeah, when Japanese who have bought the iPhone, sure, they're going for it, but actually, when you look at the numbers, Japan actually lags in terms of smartphone adoption, because the feature phones that they have do the things that they need.
And they do things like, as you're suggesting, this Internet of Things, where, Jemima, as you were saying, you know, you can be able to get solutions or peripherals or whatever that help to monitor your blood pressure. You know, people are using them to access the subway in Tokyo, for example, or they're using it for banking already. So we're going to see more of these types of things.
Yeah, that's another massive thing. You know, your mobile as a payment device, and look at what Square, which was set up by the inventor of Twitter, Jack Dorsey, that's already turning your phone into a payment-taking device for small merchants. So this is a really interesting area to watch.
Well, there's more statistics, a whole lot more. Is that even grammatically correct?
Quite a lot more. And probably more will, you know, as I chunter through all the numbers in the coming days, because, you know, to be honest, if I printed this thing out, it would have reached from here to the moon.
Well, it's really fascinating, very micro-level data for anybody with an interest in stuff and the Internet of Things.
Phone stuff.
The spreadsheet of things.
And how we do with technology over at guardian.co.uk/technology. And finally, in the news this week, New York-based artist Kyle MacDonald found himself up against the U.S. Secret Service when his computers were compounded. McLaughlin's latest artwork involved taking surreptitious photos of customers at Apple stores around the U.S. city, catching them, I was going to say the Big Apple, but, you know, I thought that may be too much product placement, catching them watching the computer, watching them. Reflexive. Images were then uploaded onto McDonald's Tumblr weblog, where the general viewing public could scroll through pages and pages and pages of people staring gormlessly at screens. Jemima, you studied digital art. So now you are representing in the studio. Has anyone done this kind of thing before? I mean, not necessarily with the internet and sort of network stuff, but you know, what precursors do we have for this kind of thing?
I think arguably not enough people have done this kind of work before. And if you think about what the role of art is in its contemporary expression, it's about asking unusual questions or making us look at things in a different way. And perhaps coming up with a few conclusions or observations that just make us think about things a bit more differently. So your instinct with this story might have been to say, oh, well, was it legal or not? And actually, that's the least interesting part of this, I think. If you think about the images that he published, they're actually quite interesting. If you just take a step back, our view of the internet is this one screen of, you know, X by X pixels that we're used to looking at. And he reversed that. So what we see is the computer's view of us, which is actually very, very interesting. Unfortunately,
when someone is looking at a screen, they look like a dog in search of a not very tasty
bone. A dog that's just been shown a card trick.
Yeah. Or porn.
Or porn. Unfortunately, I think Kyle would have defended his corner a little better if he'd explained some of these really interesting conceptual ideas.
So much of what we do experience on the computer, especially using the net, is in our head, because we are only, as you say, looking at a screen that is X by X pixels wide. Yet there really is this interesting reflexivity that goes on, because it does look back at us and it does reflect us and who we are. Would you say that there's any kind of movement, any sort of direction of digital art that might start to look towards this? Or am I just going to go off and create my own?
I mean, but surely he was saying, you know, I think the expression people have when they look at a screen is different. You know, you have a different expression. And I'm thinking, well, actually, how is it different from when you're looking at a blackboard that's got today's specials on in the restaurant? Or when you're looking at, you know, a series of books on a shelf? How is your expression different? You're looking for a piece of information.
It's less interesting than the bigger idea of surveillance. I mean, this is a public space, and well, so the idea that it's, you know, voyeuristic.
It's a space with the public in, but it's not quite a public space.
Yeah, okay, granted. But I was much more concerned by the story a few months back of the guy whose laptop was stolen, and he'd have that software fitted so that he could take pictures of whoever was using his computer. So he, without any qualms at all, published pictures of the man that stole his computer, or it might, you know, through some twist of fate, might have been someone else.
Well, somebody who'd bought the computer after it had been, you know,
sold by the guy who
nicked it.
And he was still guilty of a crime of buying stolen goods, but didn't know. Anyway, but there was an assumed trade-off of ills there. You know, you stole my computer, therefore I can look at you voyeuristically. And there was the guy at home and in bed and, you know, with his shirt off. That was much more uncomfortable to me than this piece of work, which is actually, you know, it's much more kind of
transparent.
Nobody's
naked.
Nobody's naked. Yeah. It's, you know.
You know where you are. You're in a public space. Yeah. You know you're supposed to be looking at a machine.
It is funny that the people in these pictures didn't question the fact. Because when they came up to the computer in the Apple store, they were presented with lots of pictures of people looking at the computer, which is what the computer was doing to them at the time. And perhaps because they were slightly out of their normal zone of using a computer because they were in the Apple store, that nobody questioned it at all. And it was only when Apple's technicians started looking at the traffic that was coming off the 100 computers that he'd put this software on that they started saying, hang on a minute, what's going on here? And then an Apple technician, I think, recognised a picture of someone. It is a little odd, but quite interesting, that people didn't really question where these pictures were coming from, where they've been taken.
I mean, the context itself is that, you know, you go and you look at a machine, and the demo often has some kind of rolling something or other. But I think you hit something very interesting, Jemima, about this idea of us looking at people who don't really know that they're being looked at, and this notion of the trade-off. And I don't know, Charles, you may know, but Google, I know that if you Google a certain code, if you Google a certain number, then it will tell you all of the unsecured wireless networks or unsecured Wi-Fi cameras or webcams, that's the word I'm looking for, webcams globally. So you can actually just go and you can click on somebody's webcam, or you can click on, you know, a webcam that's on the side of a building.
That's quite a sensational claim, Alex.
Oh, okay. I think I recall this.
It was quite a big splash several years ago, and I'm wondering if that still exists, because if it does, then people can perfectly happily, regardless of whether there's ills traded or not, they can just simply go into somebody's house and watch them, you know, baking bread or, you know, poking the cat or whatever.
Yeah, or, you know, walk down the street and you'll be on camera, well, more in the UK than anywhere else. I mean, maybe we're less fussed about this story than they are in the US.
Clearly, because this, you know, because Kyle's...
Well, I think it's slightly because he was installing software on the Apple gear without their permission, and he was going back every day to install it without their permission.
But he kept on doing it without their permission
in a store which, you know, belongs to Apple.
Well, that's a criminal offence, yes, but why would the Secret Service get involved is ultimately
I suspect
question.
They wanted to know exactly what this guy was up to. You know, New York, possible sort of, you know, a bit of the old terrorist.
Well, I'd say the artistic defence is quite a good one, though. You just say it's culturally interesting, and
it's
actually that should be enough.
Well, the Tumblog for the project is still live. It's people staring at computers. Tumblr.com. And for more on these stories and the other latest headlines that we cover on The Guardian from across the tech sphere, head to guardian.co.uk/technology. Mark McLaughlin believes services like We Got Tickets, See Tickets, and Ticketmaster have missed a trick. His company, Tickets ABC, provides venues and artists with a white label e-commerce ticketing system for any event that they're putting on. He recently joined Jemima in The Lift to tell her exactly what Ticket ABC is all about.
Welcome to Elevator Pitch.
Ground floor. Please mind the doors. Going up.
So who are you and what's your company?
My name is Mark McLaughlin. I'm the founder of Ticket ABC. We are a white label ticketing and venue management solution, and we're based out of Dublin and we employ 7 people.
So how are you funded then?
We are privately funded with some angel investors. Edge from YouTube is one of our sort of more well-known investors. And we are about to go do our sort of Series A based out of the States.
First floor.
So how do you make money?
So we provide a customized white label ticketing and venue management solution to an artist, promoter, venue, but there's no upfront cost for using our solution. The way we do make our money is that we charge 5% of the value of the transaction plus 50p per transaction. And that means that the interests of our clients and the interests of us are aligned, meaning that their revenue and their costs are always moving together.
Second floor.
And tell me about your background.
I used to work for Goldman Sachs, a very popular investment bank, and writing about music and technology, because I think they thought I was either half crazy or half knew what I was talking about around the time of .com one, because I did a thesis on technology to change the music industry. Anyway, I made an acoustic demo, got reviewed in the NME, and then suddenly I was recording some stuff for Universal Publishing, and I left banking.
What makes you unique?
A lot of sort of the competing products out there, they focus very much on the online transaction. And the online transaction is the easy bit, because ultimately, you know, ticket is a digital receipt. What we're looking to do is to offer an end-to-end solution, so from the online side to the venue and back again. But more importantly, we think that ticketing is going to become commoditized. So it's about the ticket plus. So for example, when a customer scans their ticket via their phone or their e-ticket to get into a venue, you'll be able to pre-program that they get sent a text message going, would you like a drink? Would you like to know more about the band that you're attending? So it's all about basically understanding your customers and building a relationship with them going forward.
Third floor.
What do you think your biggest achievement is?
Getting the product built. Surviving on 20 grand for 7 months with a team of 5 people, turning the company from a ticketing agency into a software company, realigning it, getting Fabric on board because they were the first big client that we had, and we have 100% client retention rate, and we launched 15 months ago, and clients can walk away anytime they want, so we're pretty happy with that.
Who inspires you?
Actually, I think someone like probably Michael O'Leary, you know, being an Irish company, because ultimately, you know, built a very successful business, an Irish business, and also very much sort of shook up the establishment. If you look at the ticketing world, you know, there are three major ticket sellers, and it's a $17 to $18 billion industry. So if we can have any sort of, you know, success in terms of what he's done with the airline, I think we'll be doing okay.
Okay, so who are you competing with?
Ticketmaster. They sell 150 million tickets worldwide, about $9 revenue and $3 profit on a ticket on average. Eventbrite, who focus on sort of an online event management side of things, but they're very well funded. They've raised $70 million in the last 5 months, despite the fact we've got a better product. Our biggest competitor, honestly, is people not looking at their numbers in terms of every ticket seller. If you work with a ticketing agency, they make more money from the fees than you do. So the biggest challenge we have is just to get people to go, look, you can do this. You know, it is possible. You know, ticketing previously used to be quite, paper tickets were a pain in the ass. Now tickets are digital, so it gets rid of that. You don't need a big database to sell tickets because the databases are on social networks.
Fifth floor.
Would you sell to Google, or do you want to be bigger than Google?
I don't think Google is a very consumer-focused company. In terms of anything consumer-wise they've done has generally been pretty terrible, from, you know, from their phones to Buzz. They don't really understand about building a customer relationship. So I think they would be the worst people we could sell to, though obviously if they want to offer us money, we're more than happy to look at it. But I think that we would like to build a company that lots of people would be interested in buying it, not just a technology company, not just an entertainment company. Live is where it is at the moment in terms of live events, so we just want to make it a company that many people want to be looking at.
Fourth floor, doors opening.
That was Mark McLaughlin from Ticket ABC. It's been a long time since we've heard those sound effects. It's like going home.
Where really? Is that lift?
It's the lift of dreams, Jemima.
Of course it is.
So realistically, Jemima, what do you think of their prospects?
I think Mark is a really smart guy, and I think if you look at the dynamics of the industry that he's talking about, $17 to $18 billion a year, and there really are only three major companies in that, there has to be room for innovation. There has to be somebody to move in and do things a bit differently. And he's talking about going to smaller venues, really understanding live music and exploring that that niche. And they've also got some very good dance music venues signed up. And then also talking about adding functionality like, is there some scope for including drink sales in tickets? So lots of interesting ideas, a lot of guts, and 100% retention of their clients so far is pretty impressive, looking at the numbers. Plus, they managed to survive, this is no small feat, on £20,000 for 5 months with a team. That's quite impressive.
They didn't eat. I'm imagining that it was lots and lots of beans and tins
for
that period of time, or dried chickpeas that they soaked themselves. That's fair enough. We are in The Guardian after all, so that's part of the time.
We eat lots of chickpeas. Yeah. It's true.
So who else is doing this? You said that there are three major players. Who is doing this better?
Ticketmaster are really the big ones. I mean, they have a massive stake of the market, and Eventbrite in this country as well. And most of Ticket ABC's clients are in the UK, and C Tickets is clearly massive over here as well. But just definitely one to watch.
Well, for more information, visit ticketabc.com. That's all for this week's podcast. Thanks to Jemima Kish and to Charles Arthur. Next week, Google's 59th employee is coming in to talk about what it was like to be part of the beginning of a behemoth. We'll be welcoming Doug Edwards into the studio to see what we can find out about the innards of the world's largest search engine. See all the links from this program at guardian.co.uk/techweekly. And in the meantime, the producer was Scott Cawley. I'm Alex Kratosky. We're back next Tuesday. See you then.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.